Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the prophetic book of Habakkuk. Habakkuk, as we have pointed out a number of times in this study, was a pre-exilic prophet. In this case, what we mean by that is that his ministry was just in advance of the Babylonian captivity that occurred in 586 BC. We do not know the exact parameters of Habakkuk's prophetic work, but we do believe that he prophesied right up into the very events, but we're not absolutely certain. In any case, Habakkuk had for him a perplexity. There was this real consternation. The unique thing about Habakkuk, if there is anything unique, is that the book is more about Habakkuk's questions than about what he was to tell the people, though he did have a message for the people and he gave it. But he was distressed about what he was seeing in his country, and folks, I can relate to that. You can relate to that. So many Christian people can relate to that. And that is what he expressed in chapter 1, verses 3 through 4. He prayed and he asked the Lord, "Why dost thou make me see iniquity and cause me to look upon wickedness?" The point is, it was just rampant. It was taking over the country. There is always wickedness, but when it just becomes pervasive and it becomes a predominant characteristic, he could not understand why God would seem to sit by and just let it go on, a holy God. After all, this was his law. "Destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contention arises." And Proverbs talks about how God abominates strife mongers and those who create division and cause contention. "Therefore the law, your law, is ignored and justice is never upheld." Of course, that is a general statement. We make those kind of, we call them gnomic statements, where we state something as a generalization, but it comes in the form of an absolute. He didn't mean it never happened, but boy, it was rare. "The law is ignored and justice is never upheld, for the wicked surround the righteous. They're dominant, and they're like a pack of wolves. Therefore, justice comes out perverted." Well, the Lord gives Habakkuk his answer in chapter 1. "Have no worry. Judgment is on the way. I'm sending in the Chaldeans to be, providentially, my instruments of judgment." Well, that raised another problem that comes up in chapter 1, verse 12. It's not stated this way in the text, but this is the spirit of it. Well, Lord, you are going to do something. That's good, but that raises another problem. In verse 13, "Thine eyes are too pure to approve of evil." He says in the third line, "Why dost thou look with favor on those who deal treacherously?" I mean, yes, we're a can of worms, but the cure is worse than the disease. You're bringing in monsters. They're worse than your people are. This is not adding up to me. So he says in chapter 2, "I will stand upon my guard post and station myself in the rampart." In other words, he's going to a quiet place where he can just meditate and reflect and pray and wait to hear from God and see how the Lord will correct him. He's giving God the benefit of the doubt. "I'm sure it's my problem," Habakkuk's saying, "but I don't understand, and a lot of your people won't understand, I think, so I want to be able to answer them." Well, then the Lord comes in. He answers in chapter 2, and he says, "Habakkuk, record the vision that I'm about to give you. I want you to inscribe it on tablets so that the one who runs may read. Not he who reads it may run and tell it, but rather those who run in panic." That's more likely the proper translation of the Hebrew, that he who runs may read it. Sometimes you're out driving around. You're looking for street signs, but you've got to keep up the speed and not get rear-ended or cause an accident. So You're having to move at a certain traffic pace, but the signs are too small. You go blowing by them, but you can't read it. Thank God for those cities that have sense enough to write the letters larger so that when you're driving faster, you can read them. Well, that's what the Lord wants Habakkuk to do, in effect. He wants him to broadcast the message. He doesn't want anybody to miss it. And then in verse 4, he states a general principle. It's not obvious in 2:4 that the meaning I'm about to give is the meaning, but it is the sense of it. It is this. First of all, Habakkuk, this is the way it all shakes out. There are two kinds of people in the world. Let's not parse about the difference between the Jews in Jerusalem and the Chaldeans. Before me, it all comes down to this. They're the proud, and their hearts are not right before me, and they're going to be judged. The people who are going to escape, the people who are going to be sheltered from judgment, just like in Egypt, when the death angel passed over those who had obeyed God and put the blood on the lintel of their doorpost. So it is that the people who will be saved, the people upon whom God's protective hand will be when judgment passes over, are the righteous who live by faith. They are righteous in the sense that they are godly, they obey God. But it's not their righteousness that saves them, because the wages of sin is death, any sin, and no person is remotely righteous in that sense. We're all in this flesh and sinful human beings, but the Lord says, there are those who walk with me, and they're distinguished by their faith, and it is by their faith, like God told Abraham. Abraham believed God, and God counted it to him for righteousness. And so the righteous will be saved by their faith. So when the Chaldeans come, and they blow up everything, and they tear down everything, and they take the sword to everything living and breathing, then I want you to know that the proud will go down. The proud Israelites, those who will be saved, are the righteous, who walk with God by faith. Then he goes on to talk about the Chaldeans. They're going to get theirs. And talks about them being wine-driven. The Chaldeans were famous for that. And the truth is that among the ruling elites, among the upper classes, that has always been a characteristic of people in high places. Of course, there are exceptions. But in general, they stay pretty liquored up. They're just high-class winos. And he says wine betrays the haughty man so that he does not stay at home. He's talking about something that is symptomatic, characteristic of the Chaldeans. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol. He is like death. He's never satisfied. He gathers to himself all nations. He collects to himself peoples. So begins a series of woes, woes characteristic of the evil behaviors of the Chaldeans. But the woes pronounced upon any like them in that age or this age, whether individuals or whether nations, these woes will come upon all. And so there is a whole catalog of woes ending in chapter 2, verse 18 through 20, with woes pronounced upon those who are idolaters. Let us understand that idolaters are all of those who make more important than the one true living God anything. It doesn't have to be an artfully crafted idol. The New Testament speaks as covetousness, as idolatry. But anything that is more important to us than loving and serving the true and living God, anything we put before God in our hierarchy of ultimately important things, that is an idol. So he mocks the material idolaters of that day. Woe to him who says, verse 19, to a piece of wood, awake. Give me some guidance. To a dumb stone, arise. I need your help. And that is your teacher? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver just to make it have a patina of looking good, and there's no breath at all in it. There's no life in it. And that is your God? But here's the true God. The Lord is in his temple. He is alive and he is well. Let all the earth be silent before him in reverence. So that takes us to chapter 3, where we have a prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet according to Shigionoth. That is a musical term, which we don't need to worry about. Habakkuk says, I have heard the report about thee, and I fear, I tremble. O Lord, revive thy work in the midst of years. That is God's judging, cleansing work. I know the history. I know what you have done. So in the midst of years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. What is shaping up on the horizon is a rendezvous with shattering judgment for faithless Israel. Habakkuk stands in awe of it, shattering severe accountability for their godless pride and their independent spirit toward God is in the wings, and the devastation as Habakkuk sees it is appalling. On one hand, Habakkuk knows it is necessary to cleanse the defilement of the nation as a chosen vessel. So he prays that God will, as in Israel's past history, revive his works of purging judgment, but he begs that in the outpouring of God's wrath on his rebellious people, God will temper his wrath with mercy or compassion, so that the nation, though decimated, will not be destroyed. Now in verses 3 through 4, he begins a psalm of praise, and this psalm of praise depicts a theophany. A theophany means an appearance of God. We cannot see God as he is. Nobody ever did. But men were favored from time to time with appearances of God in another form. And this is a glorious appearance of God, we believe, in the times of the Exodus and depicting the wilderness experience of the Israelites as God went before them to deliver them. Now, there are all kinds of interpretive issues, verses 3 through 15. I don't have time to solve them. I can't solve them. Scholars disagree. But I believe that this language here has to do with the deliverance of the people of Israel from Egypt and the Lord going before them in great glory into the promised land. Sometimes it seems to go back and forth. It doesn't seem to move in just a chronological sequence. But the idea is the glorious protective hand of God over his people. He cares for his people. And so he's going to save his people. Habakkuk at bottom is confident of that. So in verses 3 and 4, the prophet declares that God's radiance appeared to Israel like the rays of the morning sunlight. God comes from Teman. These are sites in the southern Sinai area. God comes from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covers the heavens, and the earth is full of his praise. His radiance is like the sunlight. He has rays flashing from his hand, and there is the hiding of his power. Before him goes pestilence. These are personified. And plague comes after him. He stood, God is, and surveyed the earth like a cosmic champion, a cosmic warrior. He looked and he startled the nations. And you remember the nations were terrified in that day. Yes, the perpetual mountains were shattered and the hills collapsed. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan under distress, and the tent curtains of the land of Midian were trembling. Well, what is this all about? Well, as I say, there is debate about what specific historical situation this has reference to. But the prophet declares that God's radiance appeared to Israel like the rays of the morning sunlight, hiding the awesomeness of his power, just like the sun rays hide the core of the sun from us, hide its glory. His splendor covers the heavens and the earth and all of its natural features, so that nature is mutely full of the praise of its creator. In short, creation broadcasts the glory of its creator. In verse 5, before him goes pestilence and plague comes after him. The prophet speaks of God's providential weapons of judgment. Before God goes pestilence, after him comes the plague. You know, the world looks only at the secondary causes of these terrors. I mean, they get out their microscopes, powerful microscopes, and get down and start investigating and finding out what is the cause of this plague or that terror. And hey, they come up, I think, most often with the right answers. But what is forgotten in all of that is the holy sovereign God, who is the primary source of all disasters that take place in this sinful world, because the world is under a curse. That comes from the fall of man back in Genesis. You know, it just rankles the wicked. It terrorizes them to think of the hand of God in any of these phenomena. But folks, all of these evils in a world under a curse are providential warning shots fired across the bow of a sinful race. It doesn't mean that those who suffer these disasters are being directly punished in all cases. But they're there, in many cases, to warn the world that something is amiss, something is out of whack. There's a wobble in the wheel of this creation that God initially created and pronounced good, but man, with his sin, made bad. Well, somebody said, but these innocent people, folks, there are no innocent people. There are no innocent people. There haven't been since the fall. It is true that if a great flood comes and sweeps people away, or a pestilence or a plague or something like that, it doesn't mean that all of those are directly guilty of some great sin that precipitated these disasters, but it means that God is still sending a message that this world is under a curse, and nobody can plead, nobody can argue that we didn't deserve any of this. Folks, we all deserved to be damned, except for the mercy of God, which comes in and offers us a way of salvation. So all these evils, I say again, are warning shots fired across the bow of the sinful race. Plague and pestilence go before God. They are weapons of God. At the very least, such things are reminders of the fact that things are messed up down here on planet Earth, that we are a race out of alignment with our Creator, and it is a red light on the dashboard of creation that we need to get it right, lest worse things happen. All are harbingers of God's ultimate judgment. Now in verses 6 and 7, he stood and surveyed the earth. He looked and startled the nations. The mountains, the perpetual mountains, were shattered. The hills collapsed. In this theophany, Habakkuk poetically depicts God and his activities in bringing Israel out of Egypt, I think, and into the promised land. And as he does so, he rises for action as a mighty cosmic warrior in behalf of his chosen people. He's depicted as standing and surveying the earth in readiness for action. His very gaze is such as startled the nations, as in terror they see the march of God before his people toward the promised land. Remember the Midianites and the witness of Rahab about the fear of the hearts of the people of Jericho and other nations around them? Well, that's what Habakkuk has in mind. And God's advance, as the escort of his people, not only convulsed the nations surrounding the Holy Land, but was so powerful that even the earth shook. Now there's another providential thing. It's an earthquake. It's a poetic reference to that kind of seismic activity, but set in motion by God to intensify the fears of the peoples who will become the enemies of Israel. Habakkuk, in his vision, and notice that it was his personal vision, he sees the tents of Bedouin or nomadic tribes under distress as the earth shook at the protective presence of God. He says in verse 7, I saw in this vision, I saw the tents of Cushan under distress, the tent curtains of the land of Midian. They were trembling. All of these were tribes that roamed over that territory. That is what is meant, by the way, by the Lord of hosts. God is a God of all forces, a God of all armies, in other words, things animate and inanimate, in heaven, on earth, under the earth. Our God is the sovereign creator and sustainer who can mobilize even nature in all of its aspects to serve his purposes. For God maintains and sustains as he pleases, or if he pleases. He even manipulates these regularities of nature that we call natural laws that he himself set in motion. Now, some scientists say, yeah, you can't do that. Look, the minute you say God, the omnipotent, the omniscient God, the creator of all these things, all those bets are off the table. That is nonsense. God can do whatever he pleases. The laws of nature do not rule God. God set them in motion. They're just regularities that he set in motion, and he can modify those regularities anytime he pleases. So take your physics and go have a chair. We're dealing with God here. In verses 8 through 11, in poetic fashion, the author asked rhetorically if Israel's champion, the Lord God, in disposing of natural elements that had seemingly defied and opposed the deliverance of his people, had God done so in anger? That's an allusion, we presume, to the Red Sea and the flooding Jordan River, when the Lord carved a dry path through them so he could lead Israel's advance of his chariots of salvation. The question's not answered, but the point is that God, in bringing deliverance to his people in Egypt, thereafter he acted like a mighty warrior in subduing nature in their behalf and causing the elements to shudder before him in reverence and in submission. Did the Lord rage against the rivers, or was thine anger against the rivers, or was thy wrath against the sea, that thou didst ride on thy chariots of salvation? To the eye, it looked like God's power in opposing those elements that opposed the advance of his people might have been angry with them. This is all poetic. Thy bow was made bare, the rods of chastisement were sworn. Thou didst cleave the earth with rivers, and the mountains saw thee, and they quaked. This is earthquake activity. The downpour of water swept by, the deep uttered forth its voice. It lifted its standards on high, like a fierce dog that its master causes to heel. So God caused all the elements to work to accomplish his purpose. The sun and moon stood in their places. Whether this is a reference to Joshua, we don't know for sure. They went away at the sight of thine arrows, referring to lightning, and at the radiance of thy gleaming spear. Parallelism. Lightning is in view. In indignation, thou didst march through the earth. In anger, thou didst trample the nations. In other words, going before Israel, the armies of Israel. It wasn't the armies of Israel that conquered the promised land. Yes, they were the visible armies, but the Lord of hosts was the one that was conquering. And Habakkuk knows that. Thou didst go forth for the salvation of thy people, for the salvation of thine anointed. There is perhaps a veiled reference to the Messiah. Could refer to Moses, but Moses was a type of the Messiah. Thou didst strike the head of the house of evil and lay him open from thigh to neck. We don't know specifically what that refers to. Thou didst pierce with his own spears the head of his throngs. They stormed in to scatter us. Their exultation was like those who devour the oppressed in secret. But God, thou didst tread on the sea with thy horses and on the surge of many waters. And that probably is a reference again to Pharaoh. I heard, and my inward parts trembled. He says now in verse 16, Habakkuk shudders to think of what punishing work God is about to unleash on his people after so great of salvation. Haven't we all at some times been so frightened, at least momentarily, that our inward parts trembled and decay seemed to take hold of our bones and we shook in fearful anticipation? Sometimes when things are bad and the inevitable is almost upon us, there is nothing to do but, just as Habakkuk says, wait for painful things to play out. Because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, he sees it coming in the vision that God has given me. For the people to arise who will invade us. Oh, God, it is as if to say this is going to be horrible. But Habakkuk's not in any panic. That is because he knows, and we know, God. And we know this principle with God. The righteous will live by faith. In other words, those who walk with God by faith will emerge from whatever happens with their future intact. The retribution is for the godless, for the proud, the haughty. But for the godly, for the faithful, there is an eternal reward, and nothing can strip that from us. So Habakkuk resolves to trust in God through thick and thin. In verse 17, though the fig tree should not blossom, and there will be no fruit on the trees, though the yield of the olive should fail, and our economy should be totally depressed, and the land just scalded with burning, and the fields produce no fruit, and though the flock should be cut off from the fold and there be no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exult in the Lord, I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. For the Lord God is my strength, and he has made my feet like hinds' feet, and he makes me walk on high places. My friends, knowing God dramatically changes our perspective on temporal events and realities. And Habakkuk says, I'll just wait on the Lord, he'll do what God will do. But we will trust in him no matter what. And that has to be the theme of every man and woman who walks by faith. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.